This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It can take anywhere from 6 months to a year to fill a healthcare job here in the islands. That's according to a recent survey by the Hawaii Healthcare Association. There are some 2,000 vacancies and some worry for the future if we can't train and retrain our workforce. We sat down with Hilton Rathel, the head of the association, to talk about how to get our young people to try a career in the health field.
We represent all the hospitals in the state, all the nursing facilities, home health agencies, hospices, assisted living facilities, and a number of other agencies as well. And our members are telling us they really are having challenges, and especially so in the last couple of years, attracting healthcare workers in not just one profession, but in many, many different professions. So we have spent the last 18 months as an organization working with our members, working with our educational institutions in the state, working with non-members as well, to see what we can do to address this issue in a systematic way.
And so how are we doing that? Where do we start?
Well, one of the things we've done, which is really unique, and it's never been done before in Hawaii's history that we're aware of, is that we did a five-year demand survey for 76 healthcare professions. Now, as you probably know, there's been a lot of work done in the last few years on the needs in the physician area. And so we're not focusing on physicians, even though obviously we have many physicians working in our institutions, our member institutions. We identified 76 patient-facing non-physician professions in the state of Hawaii, and we sent out a survey throughout the state to assess the demand for each of these 76 professions for 5 years. And this, again, has never been done before. And now as we're starting to share this information with both our secondary and post-secondary institutions, they're really excited about getting this information because this is quantitative data that they can take back to their program directors and their boards of directors to say, look, this is the number of healthcare workers in whatever the profession is, whether it's radiology therapy, whether it's physical therapy, whether it's advanced practice nursing. And so this is, again, a quantitative approach to meeting the healthcare demand here in Hawaii.
And then you folks are working with our schools to be able to start that spark, get them interested in the healthcare field, and then help guide them to basically say that this is where the jobs are going to be.
Well, that is correct. And we know we're competing with other industries here in Hawaii, and it's really challenging environment because you've got a unemployment rate that for the last few years has been less than 3%. I believe the latest number is around 2.7 or 2.8%. So it's a very, very challenging work environment. But we believe that healthcare is an incredibly rewarding career. There are multiple entry points into healthcare. There is multiple career ladders that are available in healthcare. And so that's one of the exciting things about working with the healthcare academies. Now, there are 16 public healthcare academies across the state of Hawaii, some on the neighbor islands, but most of them on Oahu. And we are starting to collaborate with them in a very effective way to get more young people, more kids in high school, more students interested in healthcare, exposed to healthcare. Now, one of the things that's interesting, when the average person thinks about healthcare, they tend to think about a doctor or a nurse because they're some of the most visible people. That's, you know, the shows on TV show all doctors and nurses.
Right.
The reality is that there are over 200 healthcare professions. So if you're interested in IT, if you're interested in food service, if you're interested in patient care, there's lots and lots of opportunities within healthcare. So we, again, are working on those 76 professions, and some of the shortage areas, that the high-need areas we've identified, you can get certified in high school, and we have some certification programs in our public high schools right now, but we're very interested in working with our principals and the program directors and all these health academies to materially expand the number of certification programs that are available in our high school. So, and this is exciting for our kids and our parents because if they don't know that they want to go into college, maybe they don't have the money to go into college, they're just not sure what they want to do. In high school, they can get college credit, they can get certified, and when they graduate, they can walk straight into a healthcare job and start a healthcare career and start on a career ladder that's going to pay, in many, many cases, considerably more than minimum wage.
Right, and you can then go in and try the dress on, see if it's a good fit, if maybe if it's not this area, maybe another area in the healthcare field.
Yeah, that's again one of the exciting things about healthcare, because there's over 200 professions. For example, if you start off as a phlebotomist, now phlebotomist is someone who draws blood. Now, typically phlebotomist, and you can get certified again in either a community college or a high school to become a phlebotomist. But people don't generally be phlebotomists for the rest of their lives. They may go up, do additional work in the lab. They may start off as a phlebotomist for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. They may go back to school. They may really decide again they want to work in a lab, so they'll get some additional certification. They may see another area in healthcare that they want to go into. They can go back to community college, get an associate degree, an undergraduate degree.
It gets them in the door.
And it gets them in the door, gets them exposed to healthcare, and gets them to see the value of working with their friends, their neighbors, and their communities.
Now, we are facing a situation where our population is aging. And so you're probably going to see an exodus of workers who are, let's say, in the healthcare field. But then there's also going to be a need in, gerontology, I would imagine.
There are many, many needs in healthcare. And as you said, because the population's aging, the demand for healthcare workers is growing. It's a growing field, and that's one of the exciting things about it again. Now, it's also a challenge because we need more healthcare workers. But again, we identified for these 76 professions, the non-physician, patient-facing professions, we identified over 2,200 openings right now. So there is a need today for over 2,200 people in a variety of professions here in Hawaii before we were fully staffed. And that runs a gamut from very, advanced practice nurses, for example, all the way through to phlebotomists, for example, which again, you can start off as a phlebotomist with either a high school certification or certification in a community college.
I know there was a time here in Hawaii where we brought in nurses, I think, from Ireland, flying nurses, because they were, high specialty fields where we had vacancies. We didn't have anybody here that could meet that need. Are we still doing a lot of that?
Yes, unfortunately, because of these shortages or because of the needs that we do have, we are, and there's different labels for those nurses who fly in. Some people call them travelers. There's different labels they use. But many of our members are having to resort to that. But that's not an ideal solution for a couple of reasons. One of them is that these temporary nurses or these travelers, you end up paying, because you're not paying benefits, because they're only in for a short period of time, on an hourly rate, you're paying considerably more than you would for someone who lives here. And the other challenge is that every time you fly someone in, they're not used to the local economy. This is different to them. That's the whole environment's different. They're not used to the facility. So there's you have to do a lot of orientation. And if you're turning these staff over every 6 weeks, every 12 weeks, or every 8 weeks, whatever the time period is they're working on, that means you have to do that reorientation every single time someone comes in. We want to make sure they're very conversant with the systems and the procedures in whatever department they're in. So it's challenging from that perspective as well. So we would much prefer to get many more local folks, interested in healthcare, exposed to healthcare.
And then traditionally, we have seen a number of folks from the Philippines come in and get certified here in Hawaii after they've been trained in the Philippines. But that has certainly helped to fill the need in healthcare in Hawaii. How are we doing on that?
Well, that's a longstanding tradition here in Hawaii, and we have many people from the Philippines or other countries who work in our healthcare institutions, and we are very, very welcoming to those individuals. We really appreciate their dedication, their support, their commitment. Many of those individuals who come in they may end up at an entry-level position and then advance through a career ladder as well, which is fantastic. So we are providing an opportunity for them to advance their careers as well as filling a need here in Hawaii.
So what was maybe one thing that struck you after you folks did this survey about where the need was the greatest?
Well, there are a lot of different needs, but one of them, for example, is physical therapy. Now, we are one of the only two states in the nation, Alaska being the other one, that doesn't have a physical therapy program. Now, as a result of this work, we have been working with our tertiary institutions, and we have two of our tertiary institutions right now who are seriously looking at and contemplating starting up a physical therapy program. Now, that's not a trivial program because it's a doctorate. The current certification for physical therapists is a doctoral program, so it's a three-year program post-college, typically. So it's a fairly major commitment, but that is one of our high-need areas. And right now, if we have someone who, you know, from Hawaii who grew up here and wants to be a physical therapist, they can do an undergraduate degree here, but then they would need to go to the mainland to actually become a physical therapist to get the certification. And you know just as well as I do that, unfortunately, we leave them, and they may have the best of intentions in terms of wanting to come back, but they might, you know, they might end up getting a boyfriend, a girlfriend. They just, you know, like the place they live. They get a job over there. So it's no guarantee we'll get them back. So
yeah.
Now, one other point in terms of our needs is that, again, for those 76 professions that we identified, the non-physician patient-facing professions, there are 19 of those programs currently for which you cannot even get certified or cannot even get, you cannot take those programs, are not offered in Hawaii, 19 of the 76, with physical therapy being one of those. So that's an example of a program, and occupational therapy is another one, where the high-need professions, but you cannot even get that education here in Hawaii at this point in time. So one of the other things we're working on is looking at talking to, you know, our community colleges, talking to UH Manoa, talking to Chaminade, talking to HPU, to say, of these 19 programs that are not currently offered, how many of those is there a good business case for standing up a program here in Hawaii? And again, that's one of the advantages of having all this quantitative data that we've been collecting over the last 18 months.
Okay, so definitely we're looking down the pike. We see this happening, and we need to do something here locally to be able to train our people so they stay here.
Well, we think healthcare is an incredible opportunity for young people, not only young people, but for adults as well. It's a very rewarding profession. There's lots of career choices. There's all these career ladders that you can go through where you can, you know, grow over time and advance over time. And we think that healthcare is an area where you can earn a good living as well, especially as you go up through the ranks. And we want to get more people involved in healthcare. A lot of people in healthcare think about just doctors and nurses, but again, there's over 200 professions, lots of different things you can do. And we believe this is a great opportunity to not only keep people here in Hawaii, but also maybe even to attract some of our residents back who may have left because they felt that they couldn't raise a family, they couldn't buy a house, they couldn't send their kids to school. We believe with many of our careers in healthcare, you can do all of that and have a very rich and rewarding career as well.
Well, we have heard, though, that salaries aren't necessarily up to par in some of the comparable cities on the mainland, and the cost of living is so high here. So how do we make that connect, you know, once we either have our kids come back, knowing that they might have to take a salary cut?
Well, fortunately for many, nursing, for example, is very competitive with the West Coast. So nursing professions are very competitive, and we identified in our survey of the 76 professions, I think there's 31 or 32 that are different nursing professions. But that is a challenge. That is obviously a challenge. But the good news is that the overwhelming majority of jobs in healthcare, even the entry-level positions, the ones we're talking about, they pay considerably more than the minimum wage. So, you know, we need folks to work in retail. We need folks to work in hospitality. But health, you know, with some of these professions, even with certification out of high school, you can get out into the workforce and earn $14, $15, $16 an hour or higher with a high school certification.
And then you have a window into a whole array of career choices, I guess, once you get in.
That is correct. One of the things we're going to be doing is just getting out there in the high schools. We're going to be talking to high school counselors. We're planning to do some multimedia, do some video, put information together, because again, we want people to understand the opportunities that exist in healthcare. So we're going to be working across the state. We're working to meet the needs, you know, whether it's Kona, Hilo, Maui, Kauai, or Oahu, wherever we are in the state, we're working to meet the needs that are out there to make sure that the people of Hawaii get good care when they need it, but also just better match the supply and demand for healthcare workers across the state. We think we're on a good trajectory here. There's a lot of interest by legislators, by the Department of Education, by our secondary and our post-secondary institutions. So we think there's this work will really blossom, and we will be able to make a material dent or difference in terms of meeting the need for healthcare workers in Hawaii.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We've been talking with Hilton Rathel, head of the Hawaii Healthcare Association, about the shortage of workers and the opportunities for our young people to land a job that can pay well above minimum wage. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for a French priest who led the first Catholic mission to the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1827. He expected a warm welcome from King Kamehameha II, but upon his arrival, the king was dead and the new government under Queen Kahaumanu was hostile towards Catholic missionaries. Despite the adversity, he converted a small group of Hawaiians and ministered for 4 years, presiding over Mass on the grounds of where Our Lady of Peace Cathedral now stands on Fort Street Mall. In 1831, however, he was deported. Exiled in California, he returned in 1837 upon the Queen's death, and rumor that King Kamehameha III was more welcoming to Catholic priests. He was not, and the priest was confined to a ship for months. He was freed after the French and British navies imposed a naval blockade on Honolulu Harbor. Afterwards, he boarded a ship bound for Micronesia, but he died en route. His mistreatment caused the French government to dispatch a frigate to the islands and resulted in the French Incident, leading to the emancipation of Catholics of Hawaii. A street on St. Louis Heights is named in his honor. Can you name this priest? We'll call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Foodland's Give Aloha program makes it easy to donate to your favorite charity, and it matches your gift. Shop at any Foodland, Sac and Save, and Foodland Farm stores this month, and designate Hawaii Public Radio at checkout. Your donation helps to sustain our statewide public service, and along with your groceries, you'll take home our big mahalo.
Community workers say that rehabilitation is a crucial part of addressing Hawaii's crisis of homelessness. That means not only dealing with housing, but with medical care. That's where the Hawaii Homeless Healthcare Hui comes in. The group, known as H4, currently operates outreach centers in Honolulu's Chinatown and in Kaneohe. It's also planning a facility in Honolulu's Iwale neighborhood, facing one of the highest concentrations of homelessness in the state. Dr. Scott Miskovich is one of the founders of H4. He helped design the concept of the facility, which he explained to The Conversation's Harrison Patino.
We looked at the overall evaluation of what is causing our homeless issue here in the state. And of course, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about permanent supportive housing and housing first, which is one of the goals. But the big issue that we found when we looked at the fact that now our unsheltered homeless since 2012 have increased almost 82%. A lot of that we've looked down to find that it's due to a lot of addiction and mental illness, and also what we call dual diagnosis, where people are dealing with both. And we felt that that is a medical issue much more than it is a pure social issue. So the concept of having the medical community come together and bring of many trained professionals. So we're talking psychiatrists, addiction psychiatrists, psychologists, physicians, social workers, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, specialists, including wound care specialists. There's so many complex problems that we decided that the only way we were going to really affect this high-end population that were literally dying in the streets. We're finding that one person a week is dying from the homeless population in our streets in Hawaii, that the only way we were going to make a real dent in that group and try to change their lives is by creating a facility like the H4 Evil A facility.
That kind of comprehensive approach is critical. Individuals struggling with homelessness are a fluid demographic, and diagnosing health problems with a broad brush can ignore serious, more nuanced medical issues like schizophrenia. Miskovich favors a case-by-case approach.
The issue we have is you cannot classify all homeless in one group. And, you know, I think housing first and finding permanent supportive housing for individuals that are families or newly homeless or people that, you know, just had financial issues, those are easy and have to be dealt with housing first. And that's an immediate answer. But the other issue is there's statistics and there's medical data that shows once someone is homeless for more than 6 months, they have basically changed into almost a whole different individual from a psychologic standpoint. Like if you're a woman and you're in the homeless community and you're living in the streets for more than 6 months, the likelihood is you're going to have suffered from sexual abuse. The likelihood you're going to have PTSD. The likelihood is you're going to have domestic abuse. And it's challenging to just not address those issues. So I think we believe that ultimately everyone has to be put through the housing first process. But to be successfully housed, we need to have a large portion of these people first have their medical issues addressed or at the same time have their medical issues addressed.
Miskovich hopes the H4 facilities can address serious medical and psychological issues first so that homeless individuals can more easily transition into housing. It's a belief shared by Pam Woody Oakland, director of the Department of Community Services.
Homelessness alone is not just about housing. It requires health care and housing together to address the needs of the persons who are living on our streets today. When we first introduced as an administration the Housing First program, Housing First brings housing to that individual first because it's very difficult to get well on the street and wraps around the supportive services that that individual needs to get well. And over time, we've realized that most of those who've wanted to get into housing, we've been able to help the vast majority of them. Those who are still on the streets are those who are experiencing a higher acuity or more severe mental illness or much more substance abuse problems, and they need health care on the street in order to get them to the point where they're willing to accept the housing and wraparound services.
Woody Oakland says that homeless individuals are more receptive to short-term housing solutions when treated on a case-by-case basis. This begins to overlap with the housing-first approach that was long seen by the state as the definitive approach to fighting homelessness.
So housing first is a philosophy, and it's the opposite of clean and sober first. Housing first is also the name of the program. And so we provide that individual with two components. One is rental subsidy to get them off the street and into a housing unit, and as well case management for all kinds of supported services. It could be simple case management, training on life skills, but in most of these cases, it includes substance abuse treatment and other healthcare needs. 10 years ago, we were only funded with some federal dollars, and it was the clean and sober model. 5 years ago, the city started funding their own programs focused on housing first. And we've now, besides the housing first, housing vouchers and wraparound services, we actually operate a hygiene center for those experiencing homelessness. We operate a facility on Sand Island called Hali Maliola, and that is a very low barrier shelter. So straight from the street, folks can come in. They can come as a couple, they can come with pets, and again, we just provide housing and case management and wraparound services. They're welcome to stay there for an extended period of time, but the goal really is to find a suitable shelter and programs to get them well and to that next step. In addition to the housing piece, we've recognized that healthcare is a very vital component of addressing persons experiencing homelessness. And so along those lines, we've acquired a building in Iwale, with multi-stories and multi-programs. The ground floor is a hygiene center. The next level is going to be an urgent care clinic, and the top two levels provide housing. And so we're realizing the importance of marrying the two, healthcare and housing, together. And while healthcare is primarily a function of the state, we don't have a city department of health, we're able to take city resources like buildings and contract with providers that deliver the healthcare programs in order to be able to do both.
The Ibile facility will also offer medical services to homeless individuals who might otherwise wind up in Hawaii's already crowded emergency rooms for non-emergency issues. Jim Howe, the director of emergency services, says that the Ibile H4 facility will help provide appropriate care to appropriate circumstances, while freeing up first responders to cater to true emergencies like heart attacks or strokes.
I think the first and foremost is to understand that our 911 system and our EMS system here doesn't differentiate by a person's address or their age or their circumstances. If you need help, you call and we will deliver that help to the best of our ability within the confines of our capabilities and also the timeframes that we're required to respond to. One of the key elements to understanding an emergency medical response system is that, in effect, here in the state of Hawaii, every time you call for an ambulance, you are essentially having the emergency room delivered to your door, wherever your door may be. It's a very, very high level of care. We're very fortunate here in the state that we have this very high level of care available to us when we need help. But the system is primarily geared and structured for true medical emergencies, things like strokes or heart attacks or major trauma. We don't differentiate the call, the personnel and the equipment and who we send based on your medical need currently. So you will get the same level of response if you're having a stroke or if you've sprained your ankle. The outreach centers really provide a resource in our medical system that we really think is going to have a very beneficial impact. So similar to maybe a family that has insurance, you make an appointment to go to the doctor, you can get there with you can drive there, you can make that appointment. You can get routine medical care or scheduled medical care. Folks who don't have that capability have been using the 911 system in the emergency room as their primary medical provider, regardless of what their issue is. And this is not just here in Hawaii, this is across the nation. Folks who don't have certain parts of their life in place, not only does this system become a method of transportation to the emergency room, but the emergency rooms themselves become one of the few places that they can actually go and have sort of a community there. So it's become much more than just medical care delivery, it's become social care delivery as well.
While the planned Ibile facility will cater primarily to homeless individuals, its clinical facilities will offer as comprehensive as what is available in a typical emergency room. Howe says that the Joint Outreach Center will be regulated and inspected to the same standards of any emergency room in the country. This way, Hawaii Homeless Healthcare, HUI, believes it can offer medical and social care, hand in hand. For The Conversation, I'm Harrison Patino.
That was Dr. Scott Miskovich, Pamela Witte Oakland, and Jim Howe talking with HPR's Harrison Patino. It was a conversation about H4, the Hawaii Homeless Healthcare HUI clinics on the island of Oahu. Wrap your head around this, BYO doggy bags. Well, that's the subject of today's reality check, part of its emphasis on climate change. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Claire Caulfield on the line today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You know, your story is interesting. I mean, I still forget my grocery bags at the grocery store. I forget to bring them. So now I have to think about doggy bags.
Yeah. When I go across the street to get my poke bowl, I always feel so bad that I just have to throw away the plastic lid and bowl after I'm done eating it at my office. I started thinking, hey, why can't I just bring my own Tupperware to the poke bowl place? But turns out that is against health codes here.
That is so interesting. I didn't realize that we had a whole code that addressed that.
Yeah, we definitely do, because the concern, of course, is cross-contamination. I mean, how is the worker going to be able to verify that, you know, my bowl has been properly sanitized? Maybe it's been, you know, bouncing around the backseat of my car. It could be maybe a little dirty. They don't want that in their kitchen. So that's a big barrier. Of course, at sit-down places, you can pack up your own leftovers, not a problem. But there are health codes in place if a food worker is handling my Tupperware.
So how do our rules compare with rules in other places?
Yeah, so what really interests me is that California recently passed a law that allowed food workers to handle these personal containers as long as they're packed up in a separate part of the kitchen and they have written rules to address cross-contamination concerns. If we wanted to implement that here in Hawaii, yeah, the legislature could write a law, or, you know, these are internal health codes. They could be changed tomorrow if they felt that was appropriate.
And our current rules, I guess they're kind of confusing, I guess, for some people.
Yeah, so the general thing is, you know, packing up your own leftovers, totally good. Using your own stuff for takeout, not good. But where it's confusing in the health codes, and I'd actually call the Department of Health to explain this to me, is because if you originally got the reusable container from the restaurant, you're allowed to bring it back again, because the idea is, oh, they'll have a system in place to sanitize it because they're used to working with that specific container. And so that goes off on this like huge tangent in the health code and super confusing. But yeah, those are the general rules.
It's funny because I remember going to an event at the Aloha Stadium and they were advocating, you know, you get a beverage and you get a plastic cup. And then we all thought you could just bring that same cup in to, you know, refill your beer or whatever. And they said no. So that was confusing to us. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of focus on being green and lots of rules being changed on the county level and the state level about, you know, reusable containers.
Yeah. And so things are different for beverages. My article mainly focused on food, but for beverages, you know, we've all brought our own mason jars into Starbucks for years now and been totally fine. So the rules are a little different for beverages. But as you mentioned, yeah, there's a movement right now in front of the Honolulu City Council to ban all single-use plastics and styrofoams. Yeah.
Yeah. I know the whole thing with straws is a big deal on the mainland and in Europe. And we've got to deal with that here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so straws are just kind of the tip of the iceberg for environmentalists.
So is there anything that's innovative that folks are trying out there?
Yeah, so what I thought was a really interesting way to approach this takeout container problem is something that's being done in Portland. Basically, restaurants sign up to participate in this program. Customers pay a little subscription fee and get to use a takeout container at any of the participating restaurants. When you're done with it, either that day or when you have leftovers a couple days later, you drop the container off, it's sanitized, and then next time you want to eat out, you just pick up another container. And so there's talk about implementing that here in Hawaii. The kind of the problems are you'd need so many restaurants to sign on for it to make sense. But there is a pilot program at University of Hawaii's Maui campus that's working on it.
Oh, that's interesting. But have you seen these machines yourself?
I have not. Unfortunately, the University of Hawaii didn't return any of my voicemails. I really wanted to see a photo of it. But this kind of stuff is being done in Portland and San Francisco.
So is the state here open to that idea, the, you know, health officials here?
Yeah, when I talked to the health department, they said it's a super innovative idea, and there's currently steps to implement it on the University of Hawaii's Manoa campus. And so they are totally okay with that because they're being properly sanitized.
Would we have to change our rules, I wonder?
Not for this program to be into effect, because University of Hawaii at Manoa is rolling on implementing it.
So I guess we'll watch and see how well they do, and then if we need to change our administrative rules to, you know, make this okay for wider use, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Claire. Interesting article today.
Thanks for having me on. Have a good one.
All righty. That was reporter Claire Caulfield with today's Reality Check. To read her climate change story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. following the state's first reported lung injury related to vaping last week, we discussed e-cigarettes with representatives from the state health department and the vaping industry. A retired doctor from Hawaii Island called in about her experience with vaping.
This is Dr. Sharon Diamond, a retired physician in Waikoloa. I have been virtually unable to breathe on walking into a shop where I was told that someone had been vaping. Also, I have trouble breathing to a lesser degree when neighbors two houses up the street vape. And this is exacerbated by the fog here, I'm sure. I had no lung problems to speak of when I moved here. I now have lung problems. And as of 6 years ago, I had lost a quarter of the alveolar function of my lungs. So there's a public health problem for people who are exposed over years and years. And as they get older, it accumulates and makes it harder and harder for them to stay alive. I have never smoked a cigarette or cigar or pipe or anything, and that includes not marijuana either, in my life. So everything is impinged from other people's smoke.
We also received calls on our talkback line following our show on the legacy and future of lay sellers in Hawaii yesterday. Pua, a former hula dancer, called in and fondly remembered her days performing in Waikiki and what flower lays meant to her and her craft. In addition to providing some wonderful history on Waikiki's golden age, she offered some interesting insight behind the popularity of the red carnation lay.
Hello, I'm calling about the lay selling history. Being in my 80s, most Hawaiians at my age, when we went to a lei stand, it was always to buy Hawaiian style with the scent. That would be a pikaki or a pakalanga or the ginger, white or yellow. It was very important, and all of us wore that in the 30s. Every hula dancer would have a lei on, and Waikiki would have lei sellers all along the sidewalk. However, I hear a lot about that red carnation, and I'd like to add history to that. Alfred Opuka made the red carnation very popular in the 1940s by standing at the Moana Hotel, and he wore that red carnation lei, big and fluffy, and with his white shirt and white pants, that red carnation was a huge seller from then on. It's understandable why the children today have improvised, because the white ginger and the yellow ginger are not plentiful like before. A lot of the forest has been cut back. The weeds have taken over. And pakalana from Molokai Farms, those old-timers, the children don't want to grow. They are no longer in existence. And when we observed our Queen Liʻuokalani, her favorite flower was the purple crown flower or the lavender. So the farmers that were homestead in Waianae, this is in the 30s, they would raise rows of crown flower, white and the lavender. But most of us in the Hawaiians, we always wanted a lei with scent. And we also had the maile lauli'i with the mokihana. That was Hawaii's lei, the mokihana being added with the lauli'i. But the red carnation is Alfred Opuka. He's with a white shirt, white pants. And we, as hula dancers along the sidewalk in the 30s, wearing a lei was every day. And I can understand the innovation of young people going in another avenue, because the flowers of the past are not available as they were in our time. Born 1931, so it makes a big difference. Thank you. Mahalo.
Wonderful memories. Mahalo for your feedback. If you have a comment about our show, please call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Lovely hula hands, graceful as the birds in motion, gliding like the gulls over the ocean. Lovely hula hands, Kolima Nanie. Every little move expresses, so I'll understand all the tender meaning of your hula hands, fingertips that say aloha.
Hi, I'm DJ Mr. Nick of Bridging the Gap. This week, my co-hosts and I are pulling out our turntables and hosting an all-vinyl week. So stay up late and hear all the crackle and pop of our favorite dusty grooves. Tune in to Bridging the Gap this Monday through Friday from 10 to midnight here on HPR 1.
In today's backyard quiz, we were looking for a French priest who led the first Catholic mission to the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1827. He had hoped to be welcomed by King Kamehameha II, but upon his arrival, the king was dead and the new government under Queen Kaahumanu was hostile toward Catholic missionaries. He managed to convert a small group of Hawaiians and presided over Mass, where Our Lady of Peace Cathedral now stands in downtown Honolulu. It lasted 4 years before he was deported in 1831. He preached in California but returned to Hawaii in 1837 upon the Queen's death and rumor that King Kamehameha III was going to be more welcoming to Catholic priests. He was not. And the priest was confined to a ship for months until the French and the British navies imposed a naval blockade on Honolulu Harbor, and then he was freed. He boarded a ship bound for Micronesia but died en route. A street on St. Louis Heights neighborhood is named after Alexis Bachelot. That was the answer to today's quiz. And Father William Talua of Kauai, he got it right. Congratulations to you. He shares that he learned this history from Sister Mary Dolorine back in the year 2000. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. A familiar onstage voice in the theater community takes the helm behind the scenes at Manoa Valley Theater as it kicks off its 51st season. Kip Webern is the new artistic director at MVT. Opera goers may know his tenor tones. He sat down with us yesterday afternoon to talk about what's ahead, and that includes a plan to train future theater techies.
It's definitely another perspective, for sure. Fortunately, I had a little bit of a transition. I was on the board at Manoa Valley Theater for 7.5 years before taking this position, so I've got no one to blame but myself for anything I didn't know or do know. No, it's fantastic, but it is very different. But the opportunity to shape the organization and to shape what repertoire we produce and all is just super exciting. We've got a great season coming up. We're going to start with A.R. Gurney's Sylvia, and it's a romantic comedy with an unconventional love triangle between a guy and he's a middle-aged guy. He's going through a little bit of a life crisis, his wife, and their newly adopted stray dog, Sylvia, who's played by Christine Lamborn. And if you've ever looked at your dog and said, I wonder what they're thinking, well, this is an opportunity to have an unfiltered look at perhaps what's going on inside the dog's head. I think it was first done as it was being developed in 1985, actually. So our production is set in 1995 in New York City. And so Central Park is a big part of it, and just the environment there. And the last incarnation on Broadway was starring Matthew Broderick, and he was fantastic in it.
Right, so if folks are familiar with that, then yeah. We've got another production in the works. And that actually starts this weekend.
September 19th, which would be Thursday evening.
Okay. And so, what else is on tap?
Well, we have two shows this year that we felt like were super, super coups for us to get the rights to produce. The first one is Sylvia Then Once, which is a musical comedy. But what's really interesting about it is that the musicians are the actors, and the actors are the musicians. There's no pit where the orchestra's playing. So it's theatrically, it's fantastic. So they're playing and then they're acting and then going back and forth. This won the 2012 Best New Musical Tony. And since then, it's been produced not that many times. It's a Hawaii premiere.
Talk about how difficult it is to get the rights to put on these productions.
Well, you know, we have a ton of theatrical product on stage in Honolulu, and we were so blessed with that. But also, everybody's competing to get the best shows. Fortunately, we have kind of a niche where we're doing more of the, we call ourselves Hawaii's Off-Broadway Playhouse. Well, we're doing some things that are a little bit, maybe a little more edgy, a little bit off. It's not the Disney musical. You know, it's a little different thing. Our friends over at Diamond Head Theater, they do that so well, and they're brilliant at it. So we're in kind of a different spot.
Right. Yeah, they just did Matilda, and I saw that production.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah. So it is. Sometimes you have to court the licensing houses before it becomes available, saying, hey, we're really interested in this. And so over time, you develop relationships, which I'm working very hard on right now.
So you basically put your name on the list and hope all goes well. And at the end of the day, I mean, how far in advance do you have to put in, before you find out that you get to put this on?
Well, I had a conversation last week about some things that will probably be available in a couple of years. So because I'm looking at what's on Broadway and what is doing really well and what's being accepted and the things that are a little groundbreaking. And so you have to, get involved with that early on. And so each time I have a conversation with someone in that licensing house, I'll say, hey, by the way, how's it going with this and that?
Yeah. I think, as you mentioned, we're very fortunate here in Hawaii because we have such a kind of a strong little, theater community, and the productions that we get to see and enjoy, there's just a broad cross-section.
Yeah. Our community theater scene here is like nothing I've ever seen. In all the different cities I've actually been there working or traveling to or living in, this is just the level here is so high. But I think it's partly because we don't have an equity Actors Equity regional house here, but we have tons of professional level talent, and so they gravitate to where they can do what they're passionate about.
I recall seeing productions over at the Army mm-hmm. theater, I think Vanita Ray. Yes,
yeah.
Just amazing productions that we are treated to. And I think when I first went to Broadway, it was very different from what I had imagined, as a theater student. And then I realized, gosh, the productions that we have in Hawaii, I mean, they're really high caliber.
Yeah, they absolutely are. There's a fantastic production right now at Palikū Theater, Children of Eden. Incredibly high production values.
And you folks just did the one on Molokai.
Oh, yeah. Last year, our 50th anniversary season was so much fun because we kind of looked back over the 50 years and brought forward some of the most popular shows that we did. And then we also had, because part of our mission is to present stories that are important, important stories to tell, but also stories that are important to our community here in Hawaii. And that's why we did Shipment Day. And it was a story of one of the residents at Kalapapa. And it was so moving, and I learned so much. I had no idea how that all came about.
Yeah, and to be able to then bring that story to the stage for your 50th anniversary was
right,
a big deal.
Right,
it's a big deal.
And we got to do one other as well, instead of the retrospective, but something groundbreaking, and that was George Takei's Allegiance, which is based on George's memories and his family's memories of being in the internment camps during World War II. And we are also very fortunate to be able to produce that at Hawaii Theater.
Now that you've taken over as artistic director, so what do you see ahead for Manoa Valley Theater?
Well, of course, I want to continue to build on the tradition we have at MVT of producing both entertaining but thought-provoking theater at the highest level possible. But I also feel like we've got a different mission. And I know this was a mission that Dwight Martin, my predecessor, really held dear. And that's to provide a place in the community where people in our community who are theater enthusiasts, for lack of a better word, can come and do what they're passionate about. You know, whether they're actors or singers or dancers, musicians, set builders, you know, painters, carpenters, sound designers, lighting designers, all those people come together to make a show. And we provide a place for them to come and to do it and to learn and to grow. And right now, we're really short on technical people in Honolulu. Sometimes when you're planning a show and you say, I need a lighting designer, well, all the designers are busy. So to that end, we're launching an education program. And initially, it's going to be, you know, there'll be the normal classes you expect, acting, stage combat, something like that. But it's going to be also very skewed toward the technical side so that we can start growing our own.
So where do those classes, where will they be taught?
I'm glad you asked, because, you know, in Honolulu, finding space is a real challenge. And we are actually currently seeking a permanent spot for it. So if there's anybody out there who knows of one, give me a call.
Okay, so when do you hope to launch this?
We're hoping in the next month. So it's a push, and you know, we'll use a temporary space as we have to, but we're really looking for that permanent space. I've got to give, you know, a lot of credit to people I've talked to and gotten advice about, you know, how to do this. Bryce Chaddick, who's at Punahou, who directed Matilda, by the way, was instrumental in kind of shaping what I'm thinking here. There seems to be a gap between like 14 and 22 years old as far as having places where they can learn. I mean, you know, the schools do their productions, but as far as really training all of that, I think Castle High School is doing a fantastic job of it right now. But we want to capture those people and train them. So it'll be, you know, after school, during the weeks, and on Saturdays. And so that's what we're planning.
That was Kip Wilburn, who takes over as the artistic director at Manoa Valley Theater. It launches its 51st season tomorrow night. Later on in the year, we'll feature the 2015 Tony Award-winning play, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, an unusual murder mystery told through the eyes of an autistic child.
There's no business like show, business like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything that traffic will allow.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we rebroadcast a recent call-in show talking about mental health solutions for our homeless here on Oahu. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call our talk back line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all the past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.